Welcome to the Space Game Junkie Podcast. I, as always, am your co-host, Brian, and over there, as always, is your co-host, Jim.
Captain, Klingons, starboard bow.
There's Klingons on the starboard bow. Oh, God. And we have a guest this week. Our guest is Thomas Robertson.
Hi, guys.
Hello. And Thomas, you're the sole developer of Artemis Starship Bridge Simulator. Am I correct?
Pretty much that's correct. I don't do art. I had to buy the art from artists. Oh. So I wouldn't say that I've done every single little thing, but it was my idea. I did all the programming. I maintain it. It's all me.
Well, I have to be honest. I've been wanting to get a group together to play this game for a while, but it's tough. it's tough, especially I'm in Los Angeles, and just getting a group of people together to do just about anything sometimes, because it's just all sprawl here, it can be difficult.
So first question, right out of the gate, because Brian's talking about trying to get people together, that sounds like you must get people in a room. Can you now play across the internet, or do you all have to be in the same room?
You pretty much could always play across the internet, but my original vision was for everyone in the same room. But, you know, people play it as the way they want to play it, and I certainly don't want people to be disappointed, so as early as version 1.1 or 1.2, I did enough optimization of the network code to let people play over the internet, and plenty of people do all the time.
Oh, okay. Groovy.
That's awesome. So you said your vision for the game. How did that happen? Where did that get started? Take us back.
Well, you want to go all the way back. I was 18.
Okay.
And me and my buddies all had Commodore 64s.
Nice.
And I had the original idea. Multiple computers networked together in a single room, each operating a bridge or each operating a workstation of a Starship bridge.
Right.
I had the idea way back then. I even did a little bit of work on it. I actually, soldered up some wires and hooked them into the connectors on the backs of the Commodore 64s and got a little bit of a low-level, message passing driver working. But I think that's as far as I recall ever going with it at the time.
Wow.
So, but the idea just sort of stayed in my head for all these years, and I'm certainly not anywhere near 18 now. my muse, I let my muse drag me around because, well, I can. And a little over 3 years ago, she said, it's time. You've got all the tools and all the software and all the libraries. So no more excuses.
Nice. That's awesome. And you say you've been working on it for about 3 years now? Sounds about
right. Yeah. I think the initial release was September 2010.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And from what I've seen, it's been pretty successful. I mean, a lot of people know about it. I know people who play it, which I'm very jealous of. and then now it's on multiple platforms. You have it on the iPad. You have it on the Android, which is awesome.
Actually, I'm very good friends with the boys at Max Gaming, which is a small developer house that I met when I came to Cleveland, because they're here in Cleveland.
Mm.
And Tim over there is an amazing engineer, right, especially when it comes to quick and dirty ports. He knows so many different systems, so many different platforms. So I contracted them to do the iOS and Android ports. And I'm generally very happy with the results. They're all interoperable and work just like each other. So theoretically, as long as you have the same version number, you can bring your iPads and your Android pads and play together with a group of PC owners in the same room.
That's really damn impressive.
Well, except that I just released 2.0 for the PC.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Tim is backlogged. So I haven't been as fast at upgrading the iOS and Android as the fans want.
So you should make a phone app that's just the communicator, right? And then you could be an away team. Like when you send somebody out for Taco Bell, then he would actually have the communicator.
Send an away team down to the planet for supplies.
Makes sense to me.
That's awesome. And that'd be what the communicate. That's another thing the communication station would be for. Now I gotta ask: is there any plan to bring this to the Mac at all?
Well, I have a very, very long list of things that I have that I keep a long to do list. Mm. In fact, I'm not sure I'll ever be done with it. It's so long, but it's culled from and sorted from all of the suggestions that fans have for me.
Okay.
And so a lot of people, want the Mac version. And I'm generally inclined to give it to them. But I don't really have a dev environment myself for putting that together. So it's on the list, but it's not at the top of the list. In the meantime, fans have had a lot of success with things like there's some tools.
Bootcamp or whatever.
Well, Bootcamp is for basically running Windows,
But there's like a wrapper type thing you could use.
There's a couple of neat little wrappers that, and the fans have worked very hard to put those wrappers available on my forums.
Oh, okay.
And really help out the Mac users.
Oh, okay. I gotta try that because my girlfriend she hates PCs. She uses mine every once in a while, and she's like, "What the hell is this?" She's totally a Mac person, and I would love to play this with her, but she has a Mac, so. I have to look into that. I apologize I didn't look into that sooner, but I will definitely look into that. And I have a friend with an iPad, so I'll definitely see if we can get her on board as well, see if we can get a few people over. Because I'll admit, I've only played this game with myself.
Well, that is unfortunately not the way to play.
Right. No, it's not. I wanted to test it out. I wanted to, give it a spin before coming on tonight, and so I just loaded it up on my PC, and I loaded like two instances of it. One was the server, and one was the thing. It ran great. Like, I gotta say, you have that software. I'm using 2.0, thank you very much, well optimized, because I also ran a client on this little HP netbook I have. It's like a 4-year-old netbook. It's not powerful at all. Ran great. I mean, it really ran well. I was shocked. I was really shocked that I the only things I can usually get through on that are old, like, strategy games from GOG, like Disciples or Heroes of Might and Magic or whatever. But no, that 3D game ran great, and I was able to, on my netbook, do a couple of stations. And I like how you can select multiple stations for a player. That's cool.
Yeah, I really wanted to. I always knew that my clients needed to be very flexible, because just like you're saying, you can't always dredge up six friends.
Right, exactly.
And the game is winnable if you just play Helm and Weapons, and even though more the merrier, just having two people play is even kind of fun.
Right. Yeah, that's what I want to get. That's what I want to get trying, because I was playing as Helm, Weapons, and Science, and I actually had a good time just fiddling back and forth between the. It reminded me of Klingon Academy, which had a similar kind of different stations. I don't know if you ever played that one, but it had different stations you could jump back and forth through.
Well, actually, I was employed as a programmer at Interplay when they were working on Star Trek Academy.
You mean Starfleet? Starfleet Academy?
Star Trek. Starfleet Academy.
Oh wow!
Those were the guys down the hall from me.
You have the secret of Vulcan Fury hidden under your mattress?
No. Even though I was the lead programmer on that project.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
All right. New show.
Wait.
Let's talk about that.
Remember before the podcast, I tell you there might be tangents. Okay, here we go. Secret of Vulcan Fury. Holy crap. I had no idea we were wading into that pool.
Occasionally, I go fishing and I catch a big one.
Good job, man. Damn, you got a huge one on that line. Now, you worked at Interplay. That's awesome, because I have very fond memories of Interplay. Loved them. A lot of wonderful games came out of there. And as you can tell, Jim was also very excited about The Secret of Vulcan Fury.
Mm-hmm. What and then happened? I was furious.
Just what happened? Because we never got a really great answer about what happened. So,
well, here's the deal, and it's a bit of a long deal.
Take your time, man. We got all night.
It was my experience, but Interplay at the time, and of course, it led to their dissolution. Of course, there's a fact in the video game industry that the blood, sweat, and tears that might go into the production of a video game has absolutely nothing to do with the game's fun or critical reception when it comes out.
Mm.
I mean, the truth is there are a lot of games that people really struggled with mightily, and they are perfectly smooth and wonderful to the player. And other games that were, you know, cranked out and very easy and the team had a great time doing it, but to the player it's a big buggy mess. You know, you just can't tell how a game came to be. And even though, you know, you're certainly not the only one who really enjoyed Fallout and all these other great games from that Interplay location at the time,
mm-hmm.
The truth is that I was never very impressed with Interplay as a company during the almost year that I was employed there. In fact,
which year was that?
It'd be 1997.
That is, if I recall correctly, that is when Interplay started to decline a bit, if I recall. Like, they had for years, they were just playing solid release after solid release after solid release. And then, like, the game you're talking about fell through, for example.
I was also down the hall.
Despite best efforts of, it just wasn't turning out to be what looked like it was going to be a fun game. Like,
well, I hadn't really gotten there.
Okay, sorry, please.
No, that's okay. So basically at the beginning of 1997, I was working at a place called Digital Domain in Hollywood, which was a digital special effects house. They did the special effects for Titanic and Fifth Element and Apollo 13.
Oh, wow. Good stuff all around.
Well, that's all good stuff. And they certainly, you know, I was nothing but impressed with the caliber of work that their engineers and artists did on movies. But at the same time, of course, they were trying to expand and they wanted an interactive division. So they hired everybody they could lay their hands on for way much money. And I got headhunted to work on Barbie Fashion Designer for them.
That was
which
them.
Was well. That was, they were the producers of it. Now, obviously, Mattel was the owners of Barbie.
Sure,
but it was kind of a business partnership. And so I was part of the Barbie fashion design team, and it was a real slice of hell.
Thanks for admitting that.
Well, it wasn't just, you know, the Barbie project was bad, but
it was not Barbie Horse Adventures. So
no, but also Digital Domain had a whole lot of things going wrong with it. It was probably the worst work environment I've ever worked at in the video game industry.
Oh, no.
But that has everything to do with them being a little startup who didn't know the first thing about making video games and were in the business of grinding its employees into the dirt. So I ripped the ripcord as fast as I could when Interplay hired me out of there. I was like, hell yeah! and then when I got there and I started looking around and seeing what I could see and doing what I could do, I encountered yet another video game company that was management heavy and confused about what it was doing and how it was doing it and what individual teams were all about. And generally a company that was really good at turning 2-year projects into 4-year projects. So I got there and, my project was not really any different. You know, looking back on it, it was obvious to me that we were set up to fail and that the people who were making decisions about the product were either too inexperienced to recognize that they were biting off way more than they could chew, or too high up in the chain to really care and pay attention.
Oh, man.
So, I really liked my time working there. It was my first job as a lead programmer, and I took it very seriously. Actually, the technology, the actual, game, the engine was functional before I left. But it was going to be kind of a throwback to the classic full-motion video games that had preceded it. And they were going to do all 3D animated scenes and characters. And even though they had a team of like 10 artists, that was nothing compared to what, a two-hour Pixar movie is, for instance. Mm. So they just did not know how much that they were trying to do. And there were management shakeups here and there. There were technical issues and staffing shakeups. And I eventually got headhunted out of there to go work at MicroProse. And at the time, that sounded like a really good idea because the Interplay thing just didn't seem like I was working with a really good team with good direction. So I left.
Right.
So, and after I left, I don't know much except that I know that eventually the product got canceled.
Right. Well,
so what can you tell us about what the vision of it was supposed to be? Because we came out of like, there was the Star Trek 25th anniversary game, and then there was Judgment Rights. And we were assuming because the thing about Secret of Vulcan Fury is it's the last work that the entire original cast did before people started dying. So
yeah.
The thing that I wonder is where are those audio tapes? Because that's like the last time that they ever did anything. So,
I agree. And in fact, I remember there was an initial script. And they did actually get initial cast members into the studio. And my producer was anecdotally telling me that DeForest Kelly was very tired and had to take an extra day to read his lines. And because of that, his agent put up a stink and said that he should be paid for 2 days. And, the management only wanted to pay him for 1 day and whatever. So I remember that. So I remember, the company going and getting audio. But, one of the things that I detested about Interplay was my general distaste for Hollywood as an entity. And Interplay was too full of people who wanted to be in Hollywood, but since they couldn't right now, they were marking their time in the video game industry, which really rubbed me the wrong way. But because of that, we had whole staffs in that company whose job it was to go fet the stars and go get their audio and their mocap and stuff. So it had nothing to do with me. I was not in any way connected to or associated with the actual actors and stars.
Mm. But were you privy to what the supposed plot of the story was supposed to be, or were you just like nuts and bolts and they'll like stick that stuff in later?
Well, I was definitely nuts and bolts, but they had an initial script from the beginning, and I could tell you that it was the secret of Vulcan's Fury was supposed to be an orbital death beam that the Vulcans had that they were keeping secret. And we had an animated full motion video segment that we showed around of the death beam opening up like a flower. But also when I read the initial script, it read basically like those earlier Star Trek titles you were talking about. It was Kirk, Spock, and McCoy go down to the planet. Kirk, Spock, and McCoy go explore this. And little dialogue options and things like that. They were at one point exploring the inside of the Vulcan Fury death ray machine. And there was something about a little girl who was hiding out. And that's about what I remember.
Oh, cool. Yeah, because I remember some of the initial art that they had done for that, where they showed the spacesuits, which were kind of a throwback to one of the episodes where they had these funky spacesuits on. And then there was sort of an orbital station that was in there. So I guess that would probably be the deal.
Probably so, yeah.
But yeah, that's pretty cool. So you said you left there and you went to MicroProse.
Yeah, well, technically, I left there and went to Simtex in Austin, Texas, which at the time was a division of MicroProse.
Right.
But I became a programmer, a team programmer on the Guardians Agents of Justice game.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I wanted that game so badly. Oh my God. I had no idea the gold mine we were going to be tapping into tonight. Oh, my God. Okay. Sorry. Please, go on.
Well, that answers your question. I was there, and it was yet another project that got canceled out from under me. It was, but you know what? My experience in the industry tells me that this is just how things are. You look at any game developer, any person who's done art or programming for video games, they will tell you that about 2 out of 3 of the games that they work on never see the light of day. Almost always because of forces outside of their control.
So the Agents of Justice, that was one of those in a long string of superhero games that failed to launch, right?
Yeah, that definitely, you know, you could say that I was a victim of the superhero curse before it was broken by games like
Freedom Force.
What is that? Yeah,
because wasn't Bullfrog working on another superhero game at the time, like the Indestructibles or something like that?
Yeah, at the time there was generally an understood that that there had been too many superhero games that had not come out or had been, you know, panned as awful.
Well, it was Superhero League of Hoboken, and everybody said, well, nobody can top that, so they just canceled all their stuff.
That was a pretty amazing game.
That was a lovely little oddball, little strange turn-based, kind of almost Final Fantasy-esque kind of game.
That was such a good game.
Yeah, I remember all the build-up that was going on around Champions, you know, and I forget who it was trying to make Champions, and then that was, you know, going to be the one. This is the one that's going to make it, and it didn't. So, yeah, funny thing about that was a buddy of mine, also from Ohio, actually got hired by Atari and did the UI stuff for Champions Online. So when they finally actually got a Champions game made. So, yeah, it was and then his girlfriend worked at the place that made City of Heroes. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Like, we have this conflict of interest in the house. Like, they're working on rival superhero MMOs.
All right, well, since we're going through your history, if you don't mind, let's continue till we get to Artemis. Because you could tell how just giddy I am at some of the stuff you've already worked on. Where did you go from there? Let's continue, if you don't mind.
Well, that studio got closed exactly a year after I started working there in late 97.
People still lament the loss of Simtex.
Oh yeah, well, it is utterly fascinating. I mean, like any game industry insider, I have so many stories and so many personal, you know, this guy was bad and this guy was good, and, you know, stupid things that might have happened.
Well, just in generality, though, like they made Master of Orion, Master of Magic.
Yes. Yes.
Master of Take My Money, yes. You know, and how do you go from that to, like, somebody just pulls the lever and they fall through the floor into the shark tank? What happened?
I can tell you exactly what happened. I mean, the interesting thing is that while it was happening to me and while I was part of that, it was a little hard to see the forest for the trees. But in hindsight, so what happened is that when Simtex was its own entity and it was making Master of Orion and Master of Orion 2 and things like that, it was a team of hardworking people, artists and programmers, who were, you know, buying into a shared vision like all small game companies do. You know, let's all get rich together making cool games. And it was run by a couple of guys, Steve Barcia and Ken Bird. And when run by, what I mean is that Steve Barcia and Ken Bird were a pair. Steve Barcia was the idea guy, the hand wavy, vision guy, who also had the drive to start the company. And Ken Bird was the nuts and bolts grognard, who could keep all the combat results tables in his head. Mm. And they really needed each other. I mean, you could see how these two guys together would form one whole, Voltron type thing that could make a great game. And when I got there, things were already significantly different, because what happened was Steve Barcia had sold his company, Lock, Stock, and Barrel, to MicroProse. And it's very customary in deals like that that, they sell out, which means that, X million dollars comes their way, and then they have a contract that says that as a principal of the company, they have to continue working there for something like 2 years or something. So even though clearly those early products were part of a team effort, and I personally worked with lots of people who worked on those early projects, and they were hardworking and they made great work, and they were came in early and left late. Barcia wound up being the only one who got any money.
Hmm.
And he took it, and he, as far as I can tell, divorced his first wife, married a stripper, and lived the high life while continuing to employ all of his former friends at their original salary. That right there was like, what the hell? Mm. But then as part of that, Steve also broke up the team. He anointed himself the leader of everything and the genius, and left Ken Bird as just another salaried employee. Mm. And since he basically had all the ear of the parent company, he could do anything he wanted, and that kind of id and ego duality got broken, and suddenly it was all id. It was all Steve Barcia, who thought he was God's gift to game design. And so he changed his mind every week, destroying months of work from people. Oh my. And driving morale straight into the toilet. And I would talk to these people and talk to the team members and say, I see the team. I see all the people who made Master of Orion and Master of Orion 2 and Master of Magic. How is it possible that they even made it? And Ken and other people would tell me, oh, well, we just basically locked Steve Barcia out of the office for the last 3 months so we could actually get the product done and ship it. And of course, this time around, when I was there, there was no locking him out of anything. Mm. So ultimately, basically with the morale in the toilet and the directionless work being done on the product, the parent company took it for a year and then just closed the studio and laid us all off.
Oh. My God.
Well, I mean, okay, so, I mean, it may sound distressing, and on one level it is, but that kind of thing is not unusual in the video game industry. My long experience in the video game industry teaches me that, unfortunately, everybody who's worked in the video game industry has horror stories.
Oh, my God.
So, and I think it's a damn shame. There was so much work, so much artwork, so much 3D work, so much animated sprites, vast arrays of all sorts of superheroes made for that game that basically went into a closet.
That's a crime.
Yes, it is.
Not only is the canceling of I mean, not only is the canceling of Guardians of Justice a crime, but the fact that a studio with such a lofty pedigree could just tumble like that, that's the real tragedy. Oh, my God.
Yeah. And it was definitely in the middle of tumbling when I got there. As excited as anybody to be working for the famous Steve Barcia.
Right, I mean, of course.
Like, oh my God, he's made all these great games that I love and adore. I'm going to learn so much from him. Mm. And what I mostly learned was how not to run a game studio.
Oh my God. Wow. I feel like my little tiara is being ripped off. And it's like, this is how the word really works, Ruben.
I'm scared about our podcast now that he's been on it, because everything he touches like turns to dust.
Oh, God. No.
Oh, okay.
But, please tell me it gets happier from here. Please.
Yes, keep going. It does. So, my wife, who is, of course, the greatest woman, let me be an indie game developer for a while after I lost my job. But then she decided in 2000, 2001 to go to law school. And so one of us needed a job, so I picked up a programming job at Interplay. Oh, wait, did I say Interplay? I meant Acclaim.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they were still around back then.
Yeah, and I was immediately put on the job doing All-Star Baseball 2002, and I also did All-Star Baseball 2003.
Okay.
And that was PlayStation 2 and the GameCube.
Wow, all right.
So that was a lot of fun. That was actually a really great team. And we got the job done on time and on budget.
Huh.
And I wouldn't necessarily say it was the greatest company in the world. Notice that after I left, the company, did eventually cease to be.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I wasn't there, of course. I'd been gone, so I didn't have to deal with it. But a lot of my friends who were still working there, they closed basically by locking the doors. And it took months for anyone to actually be able to enter the building and get their personal effects.
Oh, my God.
Then, and it was in bankruptcy proceedings. And, I mean, literally months before anyone could even get in. And my friend Bruce had a climbing ivy in his office that he very carefully tended, and it had managed to climb all over the place, and it was hanging off the ceilings and things. And of course, it was dead when they went back for it. But anyways, that was during my time at Acclaim. I was part of a really great team doing that All-Star Baseball project. Mm-hmm. We worked hard. Everybody worked together. We had a lot of fun.
Did the games turn out well? I never played them, so I'm just curious.
All-Star Baseball 2002 and 2003 were well received, but they were always in the shadow of the EA games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. That makes sense.
So after 3 years there, I got headhunted to be a game designer for the first time, an actual, not doing a job as a programmer anymore, but doing a game designer job at a little company in Austin called Edge of Reality.
Hmm.
Edge of Reality, I can't say that they did games that were, real standouts. In fact, a lot of what Edge of Reality did was like movie tie-in games.
Oh, okay.
That kind of company that were well-positioned to crank out games on the various platforms in a timely fashion to coincide with the release of a movie.
Sure.
And they were really well run, and they're still around today doing great.
Are they like a port house now? Or how does that work?
I think they're an engine house. They were started by three guys. Two of them were engineers from Acclaim who decided, we just want to run on our own company so that we can sit and make our own great game engine all day long. And that's what they did. When I was working there, that's basically all they did, was they sat in their offices and built the game engine that the rest of the company used to make products.
Hmm.
There was a third guy that joined them named Benu Philip. He was a biz dev guy, and he was awesome. He was a fucking shark. And, you know, the thing about swimming with sharks is it's a lot better if you're riding on your own shark. I think that a great deal of the success of that company financially has to do with the fact that they had Binu Philip on board.
He's still there, apparently. Yeah.
Who, you know, he'd pull up in his Porsche or his SUV, and he'd wine and dine all the guys who came in from the movie studios, and he'd do all the deals, and put together all the contracts, and he was awesome. I mean, if I needed a biz dev guy, I would always say I want one just like Binu Philip, because he was a sharpie. And that the company prospers. I still have a friend named Emmanuel, who is one of the engine coders at that company today.
Hmm.
I was hired. At the time, they put me on the Sims for the PlayStation 2 port.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm looking at the list of games. I'm seeing they've done a wide variety of stuff.
And I joined that port. I mean, I went to Maxis and I got a one-day seminar on how to program the Sims in the Edith scripting language that they had.
Hmm.
And, I was responsible for, scripting up things like the treehouse and the port, the tree swing and the sandbox, and I think I did some of the Monkey Butler. So, it's all this kind of collaborative work, and I just did a little piece of it. But the particular guys I was working with at Maxis, I didn't get along with them, and they didn't get along with me. So after about a year, I bailed from that company, and that is the last time that I have been employed by any game company.
Hmm.
Since then, I've been totally indie.
Okay. Did you work on something before Artemis?
Yeah, I worked on lots of things before Artemis. I've been making video games my entire life, and I can't stop. If you go to games.eochu.com, you'll see a large sampling of games that I've written over the last decade in various stages of completeness.
Hmm. Oh, I see. Oh, I see. Here we go. Artemis is a subdomain of that site. Very nice. Okay, let's see.
The big ones for me as an indie game developer are about 10 years ago, I wrote, just to see if I could, I wrote a fantasy MMO called Blade Mistress.
Hmm.
Then also around the same time, I made a kind of a cheap PC knockoff of Pokemon called Battle Pets.
Wow. And,
also made a top shooter that did fairly well for me. I forget the name of it. Oh, yeah. Gunmaven.
Say again?
Top shooter named Gunmaven.
Gunmaven. Okay.
Maven, Raven, like the bird.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I see it. Yeah, okay. I see it.
So, and these were games that, made me a little bit of cash on the side. But I haven't really paid for myself, so to speak, until Artemis came along.
Right. Now, at one point, your wife tells you, you have to do this. That's how Artemis finally got off the ground?
Well, no, it was my muse that really demanded it. On another game that I stopped work on called Planetary Governor.
Okay.
My wife was a big fan of that. She's like, Planetary Governor, you gotta work on that. And it was kind of hard. I made several prototypes and nothing was coming together. But she was skeptical when I took a right turn and said, I'll just do this multiplayer space game, dear. But she's come around since then.
Oh, I can imagine. It's gotten pretty popular.
Yeah, it's definitely the best. The most popular and most profitable indie game I've ever made.
Oh, that's wonderful. And even at the price point, because you don't see a lot of people selling indie games for $40, I'll be honest. But to still hear that it's doing that well at that price point is very encouraging.
Well, you know, before I ever sold it, I took my beta prototype to a local gaming convention. I just, borrowed a few laptops and put together a bridge so that people could play and give me feedback. And especially the LARPers that really understood it and said, oh my gosh, this is something cool, were very clear to me that they would pay a whole lot of money. They were talking like, it was so special. They wouldn't be surprised if I, charge $100 a station or something. And of course that's not video game software, but I did initially release at a $60 price point, and brought it down a few months later. But I got some sales at 60.
So have you been contacted by the people who are doing the Star Trek bridge reconstruction?
Oh yes. Guys led by a guy named Houston Hudson, I think. It's a really interesting name. But I've traded emails with him several times. Definitely it's the case. He has fans and I have fans, and they say to each other, oh my gosh, we got to get these two together. So he and I have talked about that, and I think he's really come to the conclusion that I'm creating enough different product that's not actually branded as Star Trek, that if he wants interactivity on his bridge, he's going to have to find it elsewhere. So, I gave him a free copy. He's certainly welcome to, look at it. But the last I heard, they'd make their own programmer to make their own Star Trek specific interactive experience.
Oh, that's funny. I actually forgot about that bridge thing, Jim. Totally forgot about that. I think it's going to be out here in California, isn't it?
I'm not sure what they were doing. I just saw a thing where they were in the process of doing it, but I wasn't sure how far along it was. But it's been long enough that I would think maybe they're ready to take some action with it.
Right. I'm just wondering if they're out here with it. I think they are, but I'm not 100% sure. So let's talk Artemis. Thank you for sharing all that. That was a very wonderfully unexpected trip that I was, totally, honestly, unprepared for, but it was great. It's a nice surprise. But now let's talk about the real reason we brought you here is Artemis. Now, I got to say, the technology behind Artemis is fairly impressive because this new version, you could have, six bridges? Eight bridges?
I'm using some old networking code that was designed for my MMO. So it theoretically, as long as you had the infrastructure, could support thousands of simultaneous connections. But I mean, in reality, of course, you don't have the equipment that could possibly do that.
Right.
But definitely I have been in a place where we were able to run six simultaneous bridges.
Oh, how was that?
It's actually pretty good. You get one or two machines dropping out or getting a little flaky, but all in all, it held up and it ran. I had previously heard of these Canadian group that managed to run six bridges simultaneously across the internet, but I did not actually see it happen. People talked about it on my forums.
Jeez.
when I started with Artemis, my entire vision was informed by Star Trek. The lone bridge, Kirk and his team, and I was especially unprepared for people's demand for multi-bridge experiences and how they really would go out of their way to pull together 12 or 18 friends and 12 or 18 computers just so they could get that multi-bridge experience. So 2.0 added a new PvP mode and smoothed out some of the co-op mode and tried to, in general, give people what they wanted.
Right, so the PvP mode is new in 2.0?
Correct.
Okay, and so I remind me of the options that are available to run a game. You have your solo mode, which is one ship. You have your PvP mode, which is ship versus ship. What else do you have?
And then you have the co-op mode, which is multiple ships together protecting the sector. And then finally you have the mission mode that we've had in for a year or so now, where you can describe the mission and the sector and what happens in an XML script.
Mm.
And theoretically, of course, anything can happen. Now, again, that's the kind of thing where I a little bit missed the mark for my players, because, you know, when I built the mission script system, what I was thinking was that the traditional or the standard mission, the standard game that I had people playing was a sector defense game where you did a lot of defeating the enemies before they destroyed your bases.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not necessarily very Star Trek. Star Trek didn't have a whole lot of ship-to-ship combat. There was a lot more story and beaming down to planets and taking ambassadors to peace conferences. And so I built the original scripting system to reflect that, to give people that ability to take the ambassador to the peace conference and play a game that was more about puzzle and less about combat. Since then, of course, again, I found that people want to play multi-bridge situations. They want to really expand what the scripting system can do. And they've been chafing with the fact that the script was kind of implicitly about one ship again. So I've done some changes, but I have more changes to do to make the scripting more general purpose for multi-ship games. But that certainly hasn't stopped people from scripting their own custom multi-ship games.
Like, what are some of the scenarios people have come up with?
Well, the first thing that every new scripter does is make his own Kobayashi Maru. Just what happens. But, of course, what that really is, you know, dump you in a sector and just keep throwing enemies at you until you die. And then people start to... You know, there's a lot of missions on my forums about, you know, okay, here's a mysterious ship, or here's a mysterious distress call. These are all very, you know, these have the flavor that people are looking for. One of my early fans is good friend Mike Substelny, and he became kind of the de facto prime expert in the scripting language. And he produced a script called Havoc in the Hammock Sector, which had a lot of fun, interesting, wacky elements. There was a general invasion and involving ship stargates that you could destroy to stop the invasion from occurring.
Oh my gosh.
And it was the sector was full of nebula, so it, you know, clouded sensors and kept you from going fast. You had a friendly ship out there called the USS Warsaw or the TSN Warsaw. And there's all this audio dialogue between you and the Warsaw and the space station. And it's a really good script. In fact, it's so good that I went ahead and added it into the game. So it's one of the scripts that come with the game.
Oh, wow. I have not tried. I'll have to try those. Jim, we need to play this. Jim, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm getting some weird sound here on my end. Are you hearing it too?
Yeah, there's been some stuff like in the audio, but yeah. I think we're both getting it. Yep.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
I'm not actually hearing anything untoward.
Well, it's coming from you, man. You're kind of going in and out from what I'm hearing a little bit.
Yeah, it's like first word of a sentence kind of thing. Or if you pause in between. But not a big deal. You're still legible.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So we'll just keep going. So there are what, six stations, right?
Well, stations plus a captain.
Plus the captain. And now...
to just do any job. Like Kirk, he just sits in the middle of the room, looks at the big screen, and tells everybody what to do.
Right. And that screen, though, can be manipulated by some of the different crew people, it looked like.
Right. Helm and weapons have controls for the main screen.
Right. But I like how the manual says, oh, you just want to use the front view screen, you know, as a captain. Don't worry about these tactical things. No one uses those.
Well, you know, it's that's what the manual says. But in reality, people play the way they want to play. So I provided a captain's map station. It's really just the science station without the ability to scan. Depending on what kind of captain you have or how you want to play, it's perfectly reasonable for the captain to be looking at the captain's map.
Right. Right. So, let's get down. Let's talk about the stations real quick, because they're all pretty interesting. And then when the game first came out, I was like, why would you want to be comms or science? So let's start with them, because science, from what I remember of the game's development, science became a lot more important once it was required to scan stuff.
Well, the earliest version of science actually was different in the sense that you had a sensor sweep arm. You could click on the screen and your sensors would look in a certain direction, and then you would have a list of the little objects that you could see by your direct radar beam would blink on the screen, and then you would see a list on the left hand side sorted by distance of all of the objects that your sweep arm was currently seeing. So you'd be clicking and holding the mouse, dragging your sweep arm around the console screen, looking for, you know, what's out there north of you or what's out there east of you. And I initially thought that was, you know, that was a very cool thing. It felt a little bit like Spock looking into his little radar sensor box.
Sure. Okay, that makes sense.
But it was definitely one of the harder concepts for new players to get. New players sit down and go, okay, what do I do? It's a blank screen. I don't know. So I fairly quickly moved away from the sensor sweep arm to a more kind of standard tactic view. Because what I was already seeing was that if I'm putting all of the really meaty information on the science station, then science basically becomes the eyes of the ship and has to tell everybody else what the heck is going on out there. Where are the enemies? And so I felt, and it became the case that even without the sensor sweep arm, the science officer was quite capable of doing that job. The person playing science could say, okay, the nearest enemy is at bearing 260.
Right. But I also liked, at least in the manual, I didn't see this when I was playing. I didn't do it, but I should have. Where you could, like, do a deeper scan and find, like, vulnerabilities for different frequencies, it looked like, for your weapons?
Yes. And, the frequency for weapons has been in for a very long time, actually.
Oh, okay.
New with 2.0, we've done even more deep information about the ship that the science officer sees.
Oh, okay.
There are special ship types like broken down, overpowered, or underpowered that the science officer can scan for. And they can understand what that means and tell the captain, for instance, that Torgoth is overpowered. They've got extra strong shields. There are also specialty captains. Like if you have normally you can get a ship to surrender. It'll turn around and go home. But if you have a duplicitous enemy captain, they will repair their ship and then stop being surrendered.
Nice.
You know, you scan and find the library computer, and the science officer sees that. So early on, it was really the case that I had five stations. I had the helm, the weapons, the science, the communications, and the engineering. And everyone understood that you had to drive the ship, and everyone understood that you had to fire the weapons. But, you know, beyond that, it was all a big argument about which of the other three stations was most useless. Of course, you know, I didn't want any of the stations to be useless. You know, if you look at Star Trek, everybody has a job and everybody's very important. So I always listen to the players, and if they said, well, comms really sucks and it's the most useless station, then I would add something to comms to make it a better station that's more interesting to play. And then they would say, well, that's great, but now engineering sucks. And so I would go off and, you know, work on upgrading the engineering. And so actually all three of those stations, science, communications, and engineering, look nothing like the 1.0 versions that I originally put out.
Right. Because, yeah, now I was reading at least the manual. I don't know if the manual is updated for 2.0, but yeah, the manual now looks like to dock with a station, the communications officer has to get permission, for example, and to sync up with another ship and tell them to do something, the communications officer, you know, so on and so on. And engineering manages power and tells damage control parties what to fix. Mm-hmm. So that sounds like it becomes a lot more useful than whatever it might have been before.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's basically how I've been growing the game. And I've always had to be very mindful of the fact that there's a certain number of my fans who want me to continue growing each station, to make each station more and more complex with more and more things to do, more and more buttons. People are already saying, you know, all these stations need a secondary screen. And, you know, on the one hand, I'm not theoretically against giving people more things to do, but on the other hand, you know, each new layer, more challenging for new players to understand what the hay's going on.
So whenever you're playing, can one station get crippled and then you need like an engineer that fixes the science guy's station to put him back in business?
No, and I'll tell you why. A lot of people have said, hey, let's do that. That might be interesting. And I have always said, unfortunately, look, I have been a video game designer for a long time now, and I can tell you that nothing is less fun than looking at a blank screen and waiting on one of your friends to come help you not have a blank screen. That sucks. Yeah. So it's one of those things I have very clearly and always resisted doing in the game. I don't mind crippling the ship as a whole. I don't mind making the player's life a little harder as a group. But I never want. And I don't think it's a good idea for instance, the science officer or the engineering station to suddenly just stop. And those players just have to sit and twiddle their thumbs.
Well, you know what you could do? You could have it so the station gets so damaged it simulates an explosion. And then that person, you know, like on Star Trek, oh, God, sparks fly. And then they fly across the room or they slump over the thing.
Yeah, or if you could make their computer actually explode. You would build some realism and some stress because then there's actually a loss condition.
Well,
and then you'd need a medical officer.
Exactly. I'm not actually planning on hurting anybody's computer, but yeah, the special effects on the bridge, the smoke bombs and the lights and things like that, have always also been a real part of Star Trek. So from the beginning, well, not from the beginning, but for a very long time, I was exploring options to do custom lighting and smoke machines and those kind of extra goodies. And about a year ago, maybe, I was able to get a so-called DMX setup working. So aside from the regular game, which you just have, you can also get lighting tool, just lights from like Guitar Center, the kind of DJ lights. Plug them all in with a special little box you can buy online to your laptop or whatever computer is running the server, and then the server will contextually control those lights and smoke machines.
Oh
yeah.
People taking off and making their own lighting rigs that flash red for red alerts and when enemies shoot you and, you know, this kind of thing. It comes with a basic script, but, you know, people, of course, can daisy chain on as many fancy lighting effects as they care to.
So I knew some people that were a little overboard and were building a full-size F-16 cockpit in their house. So I know that, like, the cockpit builder people are out there, right? And it's like you give them power tools and they're very dangerous. So have you been sent any pictures of bridge builds that people have put together?
Actually, loads.
Yeah.
In fact, I have an entire sub-forum on my website for so-called LBE, location-based entertainment and custom bridge building.
Oh, sweet. You'll have to send Brian a link to that.
Yeah. I'm actually looking at it right now.
But I mean, and people have so many creative solutions. There was a guy a long time ago who did a 3D virtual design of an Artemis bridge in a trailer. And he never got it kickstarted, unfortunately. But then some guys, I think in Atlanta, were bequeathed an old trailer from their grandfather or something. And so they basically put an Artemis bridge inside it, and they take it to shows around there. There's a guy in California near you guys who works with the Star Trek Loma Prieta crew and does a website called Tournament of Crews. And he has custom rigs with touchscreens that he takes from show to show.
Oh, nice.
I think I'm actually looking at that. I think I'm actually a touchscreen consoles. Yeah, I think I'm actually. Let me send you a link, Jim.
Yeah.
But
and there are several others. And there's also a Western. I think Phoenix, but I should go back and look. They did a convention, and I don't know. They just had the truck and all the wood and stuff, so they built a god awful big bridge with a captain's chair on a giant riser and LED strips everywhere, so the whole room was bathed in greens and blues. The funny thing is when I first brought Artemis out, I said there's got to be somebody who has a Star Trek bridge in their basement or their garage, and they're just waiting for my software.
And there were
actually. I never got contacted by any of those people. I never got contacted by somebody who already had a bridge. But as soon as I made my game, there were so many people who said, I need to build a bridge.
Yeah, I'm looking at some of these. I'm looking at some of these pictures in your forum, and this is impressive stuff.
Did you see the guy in England that's building a Star Trek-themed house? It's basically like he's redoing the entire house like the Next Generation Enterprise.
I think I may have seen something.
Yeah. Because it was just, you saying about, I know there's somebody out there that's got a bridge in their basement. And it's like, yeah, there's this one guy that's got a whole house,
It's the same guy. I read about him. He, like, his wife left him, and so he fell into a funk and got out of it by basically building what he wanted to build all his life.
I was wondering which happened first, the bridge or the divorce.
Yeah, you have to have a very special wife.
Very patient, very patient, understanding wife, I would think. And a lot of money and a lot of time.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you, if I won the lottery and we built a house, it would probably have a bridge in the basement.
Yeah. So Star Trek Ohio trivia. Down the road about an hour from you in Akron, right? So a buddy of mine that used to live there was Patrick Lichty. And Pat actually had the shuttlecraft Galileo. I don't know where they got it, like an auction or something. Yeah, he had the Galileo like way back when.
The
original series Galileo was in a hangar at the Akron Canton Airport for quite some time. And they were trying to restore it, but that was kind of like spinning its wheels. So it ended up getting sold off to another collector. And have you ever seen that movie, The Yes Men Save the World?
No.
Okay. It was like a mockumentary thing where these guys like pull practical jokes on corporate America and things, right? So the guy, I'm watching this thing, and it's been like years since I've seen Pat, like 20 years. and I'm watching this movie, and then they're in this guy's house, and they're like, oh, and it's Pat Lichty who did the design for the suit. And I'm like, holy crap, that's the yeah. It's like, that's where he is now. So he's like some college professor out in Phoenix or something now. But anyway, I saw a thing on YouTube where they were again working on the Galileo. And they've basically like stripped it down, and they had the metal frame, and they were like welding that back together, and then they were I'll have to find the link and put it in the show notes. It was really awesome to see this thing, like, you know, after how many umpteen years, and they're finally getting it back to where I think they're going to be able to tour with it now.
Awesome.
So. Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing.
But you need to put an Artemis sim in the Galileo, and then it'll be complete.
But that's for a starship, not a shuttlecraft. They're completely different things.
Well, you should be able to fly a shuttle out then. Yeah. On an iPad. Yeah,
how awesome would that be if you could? Because I did see in the manual there are fighters. So is that possible to fly a fighter in this game?
Yeah, currently, there are only enemies. There are only fighters for the enemies. Well, you're certainly not the only one who has wanted to fly a shuttle, wanted to fly a fighter, and that is also on the list.
Awesome. Now, I wanted to ask you about, because I saw something while I was playing around with it, but I didn't do too much with it, the GM mode.
Mm-hmm.
What can you do with that? Like, what are the options you have available if you enable the GM mode?
Well, the GM mode is kind of a specialized mission scripting mode. There is a separate computer console, which is the GM console.
Okay.
With it, you have kind of a science officer scan, but you can see everything. Everything's already scanned, and you know what everything is.
Mm.
That station allows you to press keys on the keyboard, and those keys get sent up to the server and processed by the script. So essentially, from a certain point of view, if you followed it to its logical conclusion and learned the scripting language and everything, then you know the GM station can basically trigger anything. It can do anything. But what I have is a specific mission script for GMs that comes with the game. It's called Three Bases. And that's all it is. It basically has three bases in the game, and it allows you to place your asteroids and your minefields and your nebulas anywhere you want, all by pressing keys on the keyboard of the GM screen. Yeah. And, of course, it allows you to create enemies anywhere you want. So you can say, oh, I'm going to put some enemies. I'm going to put an attack force over here, sprinkle them in, that kind of thing. And it allows you to do things like pick up and remove and shift things around to however you like them. So it's a fairly good script for just getting up and running with a GM mode and saying, you know, oh, I'm the Corellian commander, surrender, you people, and, you know, actually say that into, you know, a microphone or even be in the same room with your players.
Certainly
many people also asked for that mode. They asked for, you know, I don't want to write a scripted mission that people then play. I want to actually be a hands-on game master with power over the whole world.
Oh, that's awesome. So I got to ask about the mobile versions. I don't have an iPad. I have like the only Android thing I have is like an old Evo. And apparently, according to the Google Play Store, I can run this on my little Evo. Really?
any version of OpenGL 2.2 or higher, and I think you need a certain amount of RAM, like 256 meg of RAM or something.
Mm.
So it doesn't actually take that much. I'm surprised. My wife has a first edition Kindle Fire that runs it just fine.
Wow.
So, you know, Artemis was never really about producing the most incredible graphics and doing the most, you know, system challenging coding.
Right, of course.
Again, trying to capture that feeling of being Kirk and Spock and Uhura. In fact, initially, I was like, for just a brief second when I started working on it, I toyed with the idea of not making 3D. But my long experience as a game developer tells me that if you don't have 3D, people will always say, when are you going to put in the 3D? If you do have 3D, they'll say, great, and then they'll turn it off and never look at it.
Oh, yeah, well, I got to say the 3D is pretty good, but it's just pretty impressive how well optimized this game is.
Well, thank you. It's written in C++, originally on top of DirectX 9. So I didn't use any engine other than the engine I already made for myself.
How long did it take you to put all of it together, including buying the art and everything?
Well, you know, I remember, of course, I had a lot of technology lying around. I had the network layer. I had the 3D spaceships.
Right, right. Okay.
I didn't really technically start from scratch when I worked on it, but 1.0 took about a summer to make.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah, well, wow. I've been making games for a long time.
Right, right. But, you know, we talk to a lot of indie developers on this thing, and they talk about, you know, I worked on this game for 3 years. I've worked on this game for 5 years. That's what we're, you know, more used to hearing. Not like a summer. It's like, wow.
There's definitely the drive and the ambition to make a video game. And all the indie game developers that that I'm sure you've talked to have at least as much, if not more, than I do. But then there's also, you know, skill and experience. And I'm very impressed with these game developers who have very little skill and experience, and they don't even have any idea how to do 3D, and they barely know what a bitmap is. But damned if they're not going to make the greatest game. I wish I still felt some of the kind of new, fresh wonder, mystery, passion that I'm certain they're still feeling.
What are you feeling now in its place then?
Well, you know, in the sense that what drives me forward, I still have a muse. I still have, oh boy, I'd really like to make that. But I'm also, at this point, I consider myself a cynical old bastard.
Well, at the beginning part of your story, I can see why. Oh my God. You went through some crazy shakeups in the late 90s. Oh my God.
Pulled a gun on me or anything like that.
It's well, just... yeah, but you watched the fall of some really, well loved houses.
That's true.
You know, that can't have been easy, no matter how close you were to it. That can't have been easy.
Yeah, but I had enough friends in the industry by that time. In different places, that even as I was walking out the door, I could celebrate my friends in other places. I have this great story. A good old friend named Mike Steele and I were still in the industry, not working in the same place. But as it turns out, when a few days before they closed the studio at Simtex, I was working on a kind of a sped-up variant, drop frames on the animations and try to make the whole game flow a little faster, just as a test. Mm-hmm. And onto a CD. We did weekly burns and things like that, but I burned it onto a CD and I wrote just Tom's test on the front. And then when they all that stuff went into a box and got shipped back to corporate. So corporate was, MicroProse in California, they actually didn't survive much longer.
No,
sold to Hasbro. And at the time, my friend Mike was working and had just started working as a team lead, a kind of a manager at Hasbro. So, as he tells it, he sat around with his team of programmers. And a box came into the office, and they started tearing it open and saying, "Hey, look! This is all the work that those guys on Scorpion's Agents of Justice did back on that, you know, whatever that was. And they were digging through the box of discs and things like that. And one of them held up a disc that said Tom's Test on it. And he said, yeah, good luck ever finding this guy. So my friend Mike just walks over to his phone and goes, doo, 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 doo. And I pick up the phone and say, hello, this is Tom. And all of the programmers around Mike went, God, you know everyone in the video game industry.
Mike Steele, that name sounds familiar to me.
Yeah, he was, I worked with him a little bit early in my career, and he became a really good friend. We worked together on the old Harpoon, Harpoon 2 naval simulators.
Wow.
Back when we were both working at 360 Pacific.
Oh, wow, okay.
And then I followed him to California to my initial California job, which was a company called Western Technology / Adrenaline Entertainment.
Mm. Wow. So you've been doing this quite a long time.
Yeah, I'd say so.
My
first industry job was 1992.
Oh, damn. I was just graduating high school. Oh, my God. Not knowing what I wanted to do with my life. Oh, jeez. I got to say that the 90s had amazing games. It was like a real amazing time for space sims, too. Space games.
And XCOM came out. Come on.
Well, yeah. Was that 92 or 93? Doesn't matter. It was still amazing.
The same 93, 94. That was when Doom came out.
Oh, yeah. God, so much stuff came out in 93 and 94. Doom, XCOM. Didn't Falcon 3.0 come out around then?
Yeah, actually, it was 94.
Oh, my God. Damn. And then you had X-Wing and TIE Fighter.
Mm-hmm. Those were later, 95, 96.
Oh, my God. Such good times. So what were like some of the big space games you played back in the day?
Oh, I'm a fan of Spaceward Ho at the time.
Oh, yes. I've only played the 4.0 version of that, but
I really enjoyed, and I was a big fan of Master of Orion 1 and 2.
Mm.
Those were really my first, well, I can't say my first 4X games, but my first 4X space games. Because, of course, everybody had been playing Civilization way before then.
Right.
I think I came a little bit later, at the very end of the 90s. They were doing the Command and Conquer stuff.
Right.
And, started to talk about, you know, this cool shop called Blizzard that was doing, you know, Warcraft 3, which was a giant hit for the time, and then Starcraft came out.
Right. Damn. So you have seen quite a bit. Well, let me ask you. You've seen quite a bit. You've gone through quite a bit. How do you feel about this, like, this slight resurgence going on in space gaming now? I mean, when you first released Artemis in 2010, there really wasn't much else in terms of space gaming around. And now there's actually kind of a competitor for you called Quintet. I don't know if you've seen that. But,
I have. Initially, the Quintet contact. And told me that I was an inspiration.
Aww.
He hoped I wouldn't mind being, you know, inspired by my game. So, of course, I was terribly flattered.
Well, that's really sweet to hear. I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure how that went down. I wasn't sure if they contacted you or not. But that game's doing. I'm sorry?
Later, of course, I had fans telling me, oh, have you seen this Quintet guy? They're stealing your idea. And I had. Tell my fans, look, ideas are not to be stolen, but to be shared.
Nice.
And also, I think, you know, I think Quintet has a little ways to go, but I think he is also, you know, trying very much to put his own stamp on it. And as a result, you know, he's not he's not in any way trying to steal my sales. What he has created is a different experience.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It definitely, like, I've played it a little bit, like, because you can play it through a browser, and I've played it a little bit. And yeah, it definitely feels a bit, maybe less detailed, a little more action-y. Than, not that Artemis isn't action-y, but you know what I mean. Maybe less simmy and more. Yeah.
And I, you know, again, you look at Star Trek versus Star Wars. You know, Star Trek is always a little more.
Yeah, it's true.
Thoughtful and a little bit less, you know, action.
Fantasy. Yeah, exactly. But have you been paying attention to, like, all these indie space games that have been coming out? Or at least been in development in the past year or two? It's incredible.
The Endless Space, which is on Steam now, and it's a Space 4X game. That's pretty fun.
Oh, God. Okay.
Yep, that's it. We're ganging up on you. It is, in fact, the greatest.
Oh. Stop it.
Okay.
I don't.
This comes up every maybe third episode, right? Where somebody will drop the Endless Space bomb and then, yeah.
Well, okay.
Brian's not a fan.
I'm not.
Talk about not. I guess it's called Space Alert, the iOS multiplayer game.
Oh, is that the one where you have like a console and you have to yell at the other people?
It's actually Space Team.
Yeah. I have not played that. It just came out on Android and will not work on my phone, which I'm very upset about. But I've heard that's a blast.
Yeah, most people, in fact, they used it at the last Penny Arcade as the last stage of the Omegathon.
What's the Omegathon?
They at the Penny Arcade Expos.
Right.
They have gaming contests where they take 64 people and winnow it down in single elimination competition, and they each rank of the competition has a completely different game.
Oh, okay.
So at any rate, I actually met and talked with the developer of Space Team when I was at Penny Arcade, when I was at PAX East this year.
Okay.
So he seems like a nice guy.
Well, I know people who've played that game and they can't stop raving about it.
We know it's really the best way to play it is to play it with people that don't know that they're playing it. And just kind of like run up to people as a group and just start yelling at them.
Oh my God. Well, I guess on that note, we should probably start wrapping this up because we've been at this for almost an hour and a half. Oh my God. Thomas, again, I had no idea the gold mine that we were bringing on. I have to thank you so much. Let me say, you need to put a bio on your site and tell people about all this experience you have. There's no bio on there.
I certainly have a bio on my blog, which is...
But you haven't updated that in a while. I was looking.
Right.
I work in SEO. I have to pay attention to this stuff. And that hasn't been updated since 2012, sir.
That's, you got me.
Gotta come more often. You need a bio. If more people knew, I didn't even know about this stuff, and I'm supposed to be this space game guy. I didn't even know about this. So if people knew about this, they'd probably be more engaged, more like, ooh, that guy made that. Ooh, sorry, I get a little, it's my kind of work face going on there. But wow, I feel like I've been talking to a luminary for like the last half hour and a half. Seriously, this has been very surprising and very enlightening and very engaging and very amazing. So I want to thank you for coming on and not only telling us all this great information, being so but also being so candid about it.
Well, you know, one of the great things about not being in the video game industry anymore is that you don't necessarily have to avoid burning bridges.
And it sounds like some of those bridges were just already burned years ago anyway.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for coming on and talking a little bit about Artemis, I guess. But oh, my God. But so much other amazing stuff. But thank you so much for coming on. Jim, as always, thank you for being such an awesome co-host. Folks, thank you for listening, as always. We look forward to your comments, your subscriptions, all that fun stuff. And I hope you enjoyed this really impressive podcast. I'm kind of in awe right now. So I'm going to cut it here. Have a good night, everyone.
Let's have some music in here, Boiler.
Sure thing.
I bet sunshine down, but I see the only one. Trying to think I'm over you. I find I've just begun. The years move faster than the days. There's no warmth in the light. And how I miss those desert skies. You're